do. We have a forum. Music to my ears. Welcome everybody to this relocated meeting. Before I go on to anything else, it's been suggested to me, and I think it's a good idea, that we had our next scheduled meeting in December, which is awfully close to now and right in the middle of everybody's holidays. So it makes sense, I think, to cancel that meeting and hold the next meeting on February 21st. Unless somebody has objection to that, we will do that. So we get information for that meeting. I'd like to do it at West LA College again, just to keep up with our review of each one of the campuses. So, and I'm sure Tom or somebody can ask them whether or not they'd be willing to approach us. Last time they were probably all ready and we didn't show up. We may not be welcome again. Who knows? That's really all my comments. We have a public speaking opportunity right now. Any member of the public here? I don't see any unfamiliar face, so I will assume no. February 21st, and the hope is it will be at West LA. It'll be the same 12th format. I don't know if everybody had a chance to read the minutes. I read them. They seemed fine to me. Does anybody have any comments on them? If not, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes. I move accept the minutes as public. A second. Any objections? Minutes are approved. We only have one subcommittee, ad hoc committee that's functioning right now, and that is the annual report committee that Elliot so brilliantly chaired, and we had a number of meetings and put together the draft, which was sent out to you a couple weeks ago. We got some comments back. Those have been incorporated, so we now have what we consider to be the final annual report from last year that we would like to approve and move on to the Board of Trustees. So unless there is any discussion about that, I will entertain a motion to approve the annual report as strictly submitted in the package.
Second.
Any objections to that? The annual report is approved, and we can transmit it to the trustees. Jim, you're on.
Oh, I'm up already?
You are up already. We have very few housekeeping items anymore.
Well, you have a few things in your package that we'll get to in a bit, some of those being the thermometer reports, our claims reports, and a couple other things that are in there that we can talk to as we move along. Quickly, some high-level numbers just to keep in the back of your head. $1.45 billion remaining to be contracted as of September. We've expended $4.1 billion through September. We completed 200 of the 378 planned projects worth $3.6 billion so far. Currently in construction, there are 45 projects worth $728 million. And in design, we have 35 projects worth $402 million. Something that may be of interest to this committee is a board policy that we are pushing through the Master Planning and Facilities Committee at the board. What it is it's essentially a restatement of a former board policy regarding community economic development. And it's just a recommitment, if you will, to our interest in making sure that small business enterprises have an opportunity to participate in our program. The last one committed us, I think, talked about goals through A and AA, and now we've just included some language in J. Then in addition, we have moved the goals up and made them a couple points higher to about 30%. And we've been making those goals pretty well. We've been doing a pretty good job with it. And then in addition, we're also going to look at maybe a two-tier type of goal, one for the larger contracts and one for some of the smaller contracts, meaning sometimes it's a little easier to get to these goals with the larger contracts. Also, in following that, I think I was going to cover it somewhere else under our procurements, but since we're talking about it anyways, we have on the streets currently a procurement for the small business enterprise or small business outreach. A lot of the social programs associated with the program will be managed by these groups of folks, interns, etc. We have received four people proposed on it, and they're currently undergoing interviews, and I'm not sure if they're at interviews yet, but they're scoring the proposals at this time.
What are the kinds of people who do this work?
They're usually, over the past, they've been community groups or economic groups that have been structured. It's kind of a
homegrown nonprofit.
In some, well, they're actually for-profit in most cases, but they stemmed up out of a lot of big programs.
At the end of
the past, where people have started these groups for whether it be the MTA or other large programs at LAUSD, for instance, we had an in-house organization that ran it. Here, we're contracting out those services.
Is the first time we've contracted out, or we haven't?
Now, we had an organization called PV Jobs, which stood for Playa Vista Jobs before, but the scope was written. It was a little different than what you typically see, and it included some other services and some management of some functions that we are breaking apart from that group. I think they just kind of got pushed in underneath it. A lot of it had to do with the intern management in our BIM group and some other things that were pushed under that contract. What we have on the streets right now is a much cleaner contract that you typically see for these type of services. So, and then we're going to divide it up and go out for the other services that don't necessarily belong in there. But that's kind of in reaction or part of, I should say, the economic development resolution that we're going to push past. We had a request for, I believe it was Richard had requested us to take a look at, and we are doing an analysis of the OSIP program, and this is the eternal question on any large programs, oftentimes related with OSIPs, owner-controlled insurance programs, is whether they pay off and whether they make sense. A lot of the brokers will tell you, oh, it's a no-brainer, you got to do it, etc. But sometimes it's very difficult because you're dealing with a lot of hypotheticals as to with regards to what the cost avoidance actually is on using those. We're going through that right now. But in addition, we are recompeting the broker position or the, what is the actual term? The OSIP administrator. So this is the person that actually looks after the OSIP program, works with the carriers, etc., to get us the money on the claims, and works through that. The gentleman's name who has been doing it to this point is Ron Rakich, and we're going to be putting that one on the streets. After that, we'll be then likely be looking for, we'll be competing the OSIP again next year.
For people who maybe haven't built lots of buildings in their life, when you get a contract or in a subcontract, the various companies build into their contract, it's usually a line item, project insurance for that job. And it's gotten to be a big line item. It covers them for all kinds of things. When there's a major building project like we're doing, it is usually considered cheaper, although you are, it's real hard to test this. Tell everybody to submit their bids without insurance, and they will become a member of our overall broad insurance pool. One of the things it does help with besides cost is we have uniform insurance that we really know what we're getting, and sometimes when a contractor throws in his insurance and you get that little policy insured form, you really don't know what kind of insurance you're getting. So.
And there's oftentimes, I think what Dan's talking about is the economies of scale, because we're buying it on such a, you know, the large chunk as opposed to each individual contractor picking up their own insurance. As a side note, it was interesting in the early part of this decade where we had a, or actually it was probably about 2002, 2003, 2004, and there money was people were making so much money at the time in the markets that many of these OSIP carriers and the sureties were providing zero deductibles, if you will, just to receive the premium payments, because they would then dump premium payments that they received into the markets, invest it, and get the monies back. Well, you know, a lot of those folks went out of business that are doing work as well. So there's now only a few companies in the States that do it, as well as the sureties that really narrow down.
They were also the guys that didn't pay the claim.
No question. But I think now we're carrying, for lack of a better term, a $500,000 deductible. Back in those days, it was free. It was
That was the other problem. You get 50 subcontractors, and you have 50 different insurance carriers. You really couldn't evaluate how able they were to pay. And then when something happened, the contractor went to his insurance company, they wouldn't pay, the contractor was in trouble, and the problem became yours.
And invariably, some of the contractors would self-insure, try to bond around the insurance requirements, et cetera, and it usually got pretty nasty. This way, at least, we have a very clear standard policy that we know what we're going to get. And most of the firms that work on these big programs are familiar with it, and they're comfortable with it, and they know how to adjust their bids accordingly. Because back in the early days of these wrap-ups, as they also call them, you would see you basically double-dipping insurances, because the contractor would still be carrying insurance and OSA. We talked a little bit about, I want to talk a little bit about the procurements, which we're going through right now. When AECOM and our new program manager came on board, we had a lot of procurements lined up that needed to occur. We need to get some competition back into the program and start competing some of these contracts again. I mentioned just a minute ago OSIP handler, as well as the community outreach organizer, like in other terms. Those are both on the street or shortly going to go out. In addition, we have a building information modeling contract that was wrapped into the community economic development program. It didn't necessarily belong in there, so we're separating the two and putting the building information modeling and the GIS out on the streets. We're having a sources sought, which is a federal term, typically used in federal procurement, basically alerts the community and engages the interest in it to make sure that we have the appropriate people who know about the competition, who are going to look forward to bidding on it and getting the nods up and down from them.
In that process, do we entertain comments back from the general community that our RFP has got problems?
Yeah, actually, this is pre-RFP typically. So what you'll get is, and this is one of the reasons we have these meetings, is to get some of the feedback from the community with regards to what it looks like now. And they obviously know a lot more about what the competitions look like than we do in some cases, because they're doing it for a living. So we receive a lot of valuable input at those first meetings, and the sources sought to then wrap into our RFPs. Do you want to add anything to that, Terry? I know you're...
No, I think that covers it. Yeah, we get lots of questions, provide responses. It just helps hone the scope even more.
It avoids the sending out the RFP that you get no responses to.
Exactly. That's the idea. We want to drum up the interest, make sure we're hitting it right, that we have everything properly worded, that we've got the right scope in there, and we can seek feedback from people informally at these meetings, because the RFP isn't officially on the street. I talked a little bit about the OSIP administrator. Then in addition, we have a procurement. We're doing a source of SOT, or we've just done a source of SOT, and RFP is going to be issued this month for the project labor, the program labor agreement, and the labor compliance administrators. And this is a company we've had on board. They've been doing a good job for us, but the contract's coming up for a term when it needs to be completed again. And these folks work very closely with labor to make sure people get paid, make sure nobody's being cheated.
We have a master labor agreement for everything we do.
Yes, sir.
But project doesn't mean just one building.
It's the program.
It's for the whole program.
And then we'll be searching, as I mentioned before, for an OSIP provider in the spring of next year. We plan on issuing the RFP this fall, November, December timeframe, and then holding competition or awarding sometime in next spring. Some of the procurements that we have on the street currently is the MNDR. And was Jacob going to talk about that? Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about
it. It's, first of all, acronyms. So describe the acronyms and then discuss a little bit about what we're asking for.
Sure. So in your packet, you'll see a colorful guide that kind of looks like this. And in there, that's where I'll be talking about. So MNDR stands for Meter and Demand Response Program. And currently, as Jim said, we have an RFP out on the street. This program, what it does is it starts to have the district really understand their energy uses, not only on the campus level that we understand it now, but it goes down into the building levels at each campus, so we really understand our usage per building. And then from there, that's the measurement part. The other half is the demand response part, which is really trying to curb off the high peak usage of the campus that you're currently getting hit with district-wide each year. Our program energy uses in that demand peak demand charges during the day are very high. So what this program does is it tries to curb off that cost. During that time, cost is very high, almost 10 times the amount. So what this program does is it meters and it has a response program for those high peak demand charges.
What do you mean response? Does it cut that?
Yeah,
automatically?
So what it does is it ties into the current building energy management systems. And what it does is it has set levels of pre-programmed requirements that will go around to every campus, and it's tailored per campus use. And what it does is it starts saying, you know, if AC is set at a pool temperature delivering at, let's say, 45 degrees, out from the central plants, they'll, at the building level, turn it up to, let's say, 45 or 50 degrees. So with that being said, when it happens throughout the campus and throughout the district, you start being able to effectively shave off 10 to 15% of your peak demand charges, which translates into a significant cost reduction for the district. So that's the current program that we're doing with the MNDR. It's in the procurement process currently. And the current status, on October 14th, we received proposals back, and we plan to go to the December board authorization.
How complicated is this to maintain?
Not complicated at all, actually. It's something that we should have done during the construction process originally. It was oftentimes value engineered out as a cost. So think in the simplest terms, as opposed to having meters for each building to determine what the energy usage looks like, we have one big meter at the end of the campus that just runs, and it tells us what the usage is for the campus or for the college. By metering each of the individual buildings, we'll be able to determine where there's what we call energy hogs, meaning we have to look at what the usage is at that particular structure and determine whether there's a way to mitigate some of those costs. So is it an old building that's not energy efficient? Is it not being monitored and ran efficiently, meaning they just have their dishes set at 62 and run it all day long? And if there's other ways we can do it, this also plays into space utilization a little bit. If we see, for instance, that a building is being used, you have one class in it at a certain amount of time, but you've got all full utilities on and it's using up a lot of power, maybe we move that class over to another building that's 80% occupied at that particular time. Another interesting thing about this, and one of what helps in the planning, is when you look at a college or a campus or where you have several facilities across it, you'll see oftentimes that 80% of the power or the utility consumption will be taken up by about 20% of the buildings. And in some cases, that may be necessary. You know, if you're over at Caltech and you're splitting atoms, it's gonna suck up some power. But in other cases, there might just be some inefficiencies that we can then fix by monitoring these and mitigating them.
Yeah, within the program also, just to add on to what Jim is saying, the RFP had a five-year performance guarantee written into the contract. So any the vendor who's chosen will maintain the system for 5 years. And in that time, like the parts, if you look at the parts to these, they're meters. They're not moving parts. It's a stagnant. It measures electricity, which is a pulse type of system. So there's very low maintenance. It's not like a central plant, which has a lot of...
That was my question about how much it controls the central plant, because that's when it gets complicated. And if you have a central plant that gets overridden by these meters, and people are in playing around with the thermostats trying to get it down to 62, but the basic water temperature has been kicked up to 55, then you get people who start to short-circuit it by clever little means.
Yeah, the central plants is not going to be, in this program, the central plants, there's no controls being put on the central plants. It has its own controls.
So this is just to let us know what's going on.
The meter, the measurement portion, the meter portion, yes, is to let us know. The demand response is on a building level to, let's say, like close an air handler at the specific room, or help control flow, which then sends a signal back to the central plant to ramp down air handler units. It's on a secondary level response. It's not directly within this program, but the central plants are able to handle this type of response measure.
But Dan, that's something we've talked about before, and I think it's a real challenge for our district, is we have put in some very sophisticated central plants in many cases. And what we've probably not done well is to train the staff who's supposedly managing these central plants to make sure that they're optimized. So what you then have is folks in there hand tooling these very elaborate systems that might not be familiar with those, the sophistication there.
Probably because they're getting yelled at.
Oh, of course.
This building is above 76.
This building's too cold. This building's too warm.
People get yelled at.
Yeah, of course. And in such cases, so what we have done is we've gone back and did a study of the central plants just recently. The conclusion was that we could save a tremendous amount of money just by going back and recommissioning these things and getting them back into shape where they're supposed to be, and then do additional training with our facilities folks to try to bring them up to speed on how to better manage them and how they're supposed to better operate.
Good luck.
Just a question. Systems that are put in, or the central plant, or anything like that, or no? Basically, imaging and systems that are put in a lot of times, maintenance and whatever, we're there on the vessel, and they leave, and they go in the morning and turn it on at night. So,
that's one of the things we're looking at too, Dave. That's why we had an energy, what we call an energy audit. Right. Basically, we did it in-house, because a lot of the outside vendors have a vested interest in defining solutions for you. So what we really wanted to do was get an objective view, brought in some energy experts that didn't necessarily have a vested interest in defining defects, go in and find out where those issues were with controls, with regards to how they operated with the central plants, et cetera, and look at other things. And with this information that we have, it'll help us make some decisions on how we better monitor these things, how we better operate it. Because someone would make it a control.
Jim, you know, there's technology now that allow you to store electricity. Have we looked into that? In other words, one of the problems with electricity is
you make it.
You're making it. They now have the technology, so I'm looking at one of them right now, if I understand it.
Yeah.
But where you can literally store this stuff and then use it later.
Yeah, there's the new way of battery storage is exactly what you're talking about, is you have smaller battery systems that are tied back into the main grid, and what it does is when you hit those peak demand charges, it injects the battery storage power into the grid system. It depends on how you get if it's incentivized right now. If it is, then there's a payback that's kind of realized. If it's not incentivized, the cost to install that system and the life usually lasts about 10 years, those batteries. It doesn't really pay back that well. It's not there just yet. It's almost there.
We're 5 years away from batteries that make sense.
Yeah, correct. They're upgrading into lithium storage. So there's new technology coming out, definitely batteries.
Okay. Anything else, Jacob?
Do you want me to move into the other energy, or do you want to wait till the end?
You know, keep rolling.
Okay. Jim already mentioned some of the things that the energy program, the PMO energy program, will be looking towards in moving forward. But in the handout, the path moving forward, the PMO office did a district-wide assessment of all the energy usages dating back to 2000. I'd say to 2001, and kind of measured, took all the measurements of energy usages, analyzed when buildings came online to see how that profile got affected. We then looked at how the past energy initiatives that the district took on, like photovoltaics, affected that line. On every single campus, and then also looked at how demand side response programs and central plant programs affected energy. And that report's going to be coming out soon. But what we found is that energy was reduced at every single campus. Every single campus has varying effects. But as on a conglomerate whole, we looked at how we were going to move forward. And there's a kind of a gap. There's an existing energy gap, and we understand where we are right now, the savings that we receive. And then we have the future gap moving down into the next 5 years and the measures of what we will be doing. And in that, we had to look into what will sustain us for the future. With our existing programs that we really have done. Some of the things that we're doing, like you know, is the measured demand response system, so we understand energy better. Can't really manage energy that you don't understand, so that's one of the programs we're doing. The next step we're doing is reevaluating the central plants, retro-commissioning the central plants. That's one of the plans that we need to do, because there are definitely some efficiencies that we can have with the central plants. I think originally, when central plants were being installed throughout the different campuses, they were designed to a certain load factor. And now we know what the roadmap is, the future build-out, we need to really reevaluate did that original basis of design really meet the final build-out? And what we'll find is that there's efficiencies that we need to do, and in some cases, there'll probably be some additional capacity we need to put on to the central plants. The renewable energies, we've done renewable energies a lot at this district, but we'll be looking to maybe capture those remaining campuses that might be able to have solar photovoltaics put on there. At today's day and age, you can have solar payback within 15, 16, 17 years, which is within the 25-year lifespan of the system itself. So it's actually a good program to actually get into right now.
We sell off the tax credits.
I think that didn't really pan out that well. I think it's still there, and everyone's back. And I think
everybody always tries to figure out how to do that. I'm on all these nonprofit boards, and they look at photovoltaics and they go, "Geez, I wish we could pay taxes so we could eliminate our tax burden."
You can.
You can do it.
It just requires a massively convoluted financial exercise, but it can be done because we have had done that kind of thing in the past as part of took the tax credits as part of a reduction in the cost for an energy contract or something.
So just by mentioning these three things, we can look to the budget, and that will really help us determine what we can really do. And the 40J energy budget on the next slide, the current budget at where we stand right now, originally the budget was at $132 million. $93 million has been currently spent, and what's remaining in the funds of unspent monies is about $39 million. So, at the immediate future spendings, we have about $10.5 million budgeted for the MNDR program, and about $6 million budgeted for remaining photovoltaic projects from the previous program. And moving forward, we have about $20.5 million for this energy roadmap. And it's a lot of money. But when you look at the initiatives, the remaining initiatives that we want to do, spread out between over 5 years, it's actually not a lot of money. And the PMO office has to be very careful in how we spend it in order to make sure the district is in its best place. So after 5 years, we have proper build out.
Thank you, Jerry. Construction update. Some of the projects that have been substantially complete since the last time we spoke would include the city athletic field, $4.1 million parking structure, took occupancy on October 14th. At Mission College, there was some playground equipment and that was put into place, took substantial completion on September 27th. And it was part of the overall Child Development Center, which was a much larger project of $13.2 million. As we do each time we meet, we talk about some of the projects that keep us awake at night and some of the ones where we've got a lot of room for improvement and we're working through things. One of those right now is what we call, refer to as the Pierce Northam Mall at Pierce College. This was a project that was contracted for long ago, and the contractor was terminated midstream, had completed some of the work, and has been left dormant for a good period of time. They then developed a design build procurement to go back out, and when we received the proposals, it was apparent that there was a tremendous amount of scope holes. There was not a good job done of scoping that project, in my opinion. And by that I mean there's a tremendous amount of risk. This project consists of 11 classroom and administration buildings, and it's all modernization work. So it's messy stuff with a lot of unknowns. In addition, there's a bunch of site work and hardscape to do in there. I think about $9 million of it, almost a third of the work is going to be underground and sitescape. and we don't necessarily know what's running through those campuses, and that's where we run into a lot of problems in all of our jobs here. What we're currently in the process of, we've canceled that last procurement, a design-build procurement. We are bringing in a new architect to help scope another job. This job will be a design assist lease-leaseback, in which case we hire a general contractor on the front end, provide professional services to go in and evaluate the scope and assist the design on the front end of putting together the contract. We then put out a lease-leaseback procurement to determine who is going to get the construction. This will allow us to identify any of the risk and get them ahead of time. Also, we'll be able to build in contingencies into the delivery that both the general contractor will carry and that we'll carry going into the project. We also have a tremendous amount of comments from that last design build procurement, if you will, that the general contractors had provided to us. And it's just going to be a much better, much more complete, tighter package.
These are all occupied buildings, I suppose.
Yeah. Some are not. Yeah.
So there's I take it the problem is there's a lot of discovery that needs to be done.
Yeah.
Walls that need to be opened up, ceilings, whatever.
Absolutely.
And so we're going to do that at our risk, figure it out, and then go for it.
That's correct. And build a very tight scope. Because right now there's just too much risk built into the contracts and the competition. If you were to try to bring it out now, I don't know what your final price would be on it. And we even saw a huge gap in the proposers' numbers, and I'll get them a little off, but I think anywhere from $30 to $40 million. When you look at that, you know you've got a problem. I mean, that's a 30% spread between three bidders. That's bad.
Nobody knows.
That's exactly it. And you talk to the high bidder or the high person, they're like, man, we just don't know. We don't even know if the equipment that was put in before the contract was terminated, if it still works.
How old are they?
I want to say they're from the 50s. I think they're from the 50s.
And they're like one story?
Yes.
Yeah. And we're redoing them into classrooms and history?
Well, we're tightening them all up and making them nicer. They're old and they need to be modernized. That's what most of the work consists of.
Yeah, but there's an academic use for them, or is it?
Yeah. No, they're required. They certainly need them out there. If you had to do it over again and start from the very beginning, I would probably look at bulldozing them all and starting over. And building a purpose-built structure that housed all the same classrooms that you'd be building in each of those. We've sunk far too much cost into it to start over, unfortunately.
Oftentimes, exactly the wrong way to look at it, but that's not really what here.
Well, the reason I'm saying it, Dan, is because we've already paid another contractor to get halfway through it. They've already done all the soft costs and the designs at least once, and then with a design build procurement, and now we're finally building a proper package to get it all done.
Are they going
to
be good buildings when we're done?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they'll be in good shape, but they're still stick frame. I mean, it's old stick frame construction. I mean, yeah, take it down and put up a building. That's usually how it pencils out. But we're gonna make a pretty good package out of it. It'll get done. It'll be serviceable, and I think everybody will be happy with it. But we're all done. The next one, I think, is pretty exciting, and that's the Southwest College, the School of Math and Science. If you remember, this was a building that we had slated for renovation. And once we started digging into it and doing exploration, we found out we had a pretty pretty sick building on our hands. It was a little rotten. It's about 20 years old. And this gets into another one of those conversations as to whether, well, should we go back and modernize and rebuild it? Because we had to keep tearing it apart. So it's now torn down to steel and concrete. It's all that's basically left on the structure. And in this case, the good news is we're going to take it down. It's going to go away entirely. We're going to build two purpose-built buildings. It'll actually give us a smaller amount of square footage, but it'll be more specialized for exactly what they want to be needing. And to help pay for it, we've eliminated another building that they're not going to need, that they were going to go into construction for. But the solution is good. And this building has been sitting out there. It really looks like, you know, Beirut. It's bad. And it doesn't look good. And the community's sick of it, and the folks on the campus are sick of it, and we're sick of it. And we'd like to move on it as quickly as if we can, obviously. There's still got to be some work done in the state to tear it down during winter break. So we've got Hensel Phelps under contract out there. I think we're very fortunate to have them working for us on this.
Great firm.
And it's a complex structure, complex job, and they've got good people. They are good subs, and they can move fast. So I think that's, while it is a challenge, it's a good news story.
You said we have some problems with the state?
Yeah, with the way that this one was funded. But when we went back and looked at it, we did research. We had two different attorneys' opinions. At one point in time, we did not think we were going to be able to take it down because
the funding is longer than the filter.
Yeah, and we thought we would have to wait another 2 years to do it. But that's not necessarily the case. So we're going to be able to move on.
Did all the local stakeholders agree and get good consensus that this was the thing to do?
Yeah, I think I think everybody's very excited about it.
So how quickly can this thing accelerate and actually start to look like a new building?
Well, the first thing we've got to do is tear it down, and we'll at the same time, we're going through design right now on those other two structures that I talked about. And that's in the process right now on a design-build contract. So we already have Hensel Phelps on a design-build contract going forward with this stuff. So we're moving along. We've talked to DSA. We've been working very closely with DSA. They know we need to expedite this project, and they've been very responsive with that. They're really trying hard to get better.
When will the teardown be done?
We're hoping over winter break.
Ooh, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
I guess then they'd be happy not to have that ice.
It would be a good Christmas present for everyone.
Yeah, that's good.
We have the, I don't necessarily want to call this one a problem project. This is more of a problem decision, and this is the Valley College Media and Performing Arts Center that we have out there. This is the one, I believe, we spoke about it before. It's a beautiful structure, beautiful design, but it's quite a bit more than what's really required. They've over-designed it a bit. We've got 115,000 square feet with four different theaters in it right now, as it currently stands. It would probably be close to a $90 million job. What we're doing is we brought an outside architect in to, if you will, validate the design, and then to start doing some economic analysis.
And the original?
Stephen Ehrlich.
Wow.
And if you know Ehrlich,
he's
kind of a black cape guy and does some absolutely beautiful structures if you can build them. I've worked with Stephen before.
Just get rid of the light sconces. He said 20.
We're looking at all of those options with regards to trying to get this into something that's, and the real problem comes in here is when you start doing the cap load ratios and the comparisons and the formulas associated with the state and what's laughable and what's not. If we built it as is, it would be entirely overbuilt. We would have the cap load ratios would be over double what they should be. And then in addition, we would incur about $500,000 additional maintenance costs just to keep that building up. This is coming out of college that's been running a deficit for the last several years. And to saddle them with another $500,000 in maintenance operations just on one building probably would not be a good
Is this one. Designed to be a public use space or only a space for students to craft?
I think their idea ultimately was to try to monetize the space once they've built it. You can only do so much of that. I mean, with public funds, build something and then try to make money off of it. But we did that analysis, and what the other theaters like Santa Monica and CSUN and some of these other theaters are averaging 0.7 days a month in rental rates is what they'd actually received. So
it's a wildly competitive.
I think they had one idea, kind of a business model, but it just doesn't necessarily pencil. So we have to, but we spent a tremendous amount in designing this building. So what do we
the
have
design
to
design is all done.
Yes, sir. It's ready to go. They got pushed out of DSA approved in May. Yeah. And what will be part of this exercise will also be if we built this to the right size, or if we designed it to the right size, or if we de-scoped some of it, if we could de-scope some of it, save some of the design, and then run the numbers versus what we've already spent in sunk costs on this particular structure, and then top it with another $90 million in construction costs, where does it make sense monetarily? I mean,
He's not willing to redesign?
Stephen's not, we haven't asked him yet, because unfortunately, Stuart, he followed his contract. I mean, he was being given direction from the colleges, and
does this college have a theater program?
They do, and they desperately need a theater.
Okay, so they do need a facility.
Oh yeah, the one they have is terrible. So they really need one. Well, there's some different. They're not just theaters. They're one of them is a viewing room. Yeah, and one's a viewing room and a few other things.
Orchestra also.
I'm sorry.
I think they have an orchestra, or they used to.
So they desperately need a new theater building. There's no question they do. It's just that we don't want to end up being accused of overbuilding and being so excessive on the designs and so excessive in the cost, and that we're managing this responsibly and we're not setting the campus up for failure with regards to maintaining and operating it. So we have to do that analysis and perform the analysis, and then, as I said, we're bringing in another outside architect to validate some of the designs, to take a look at what the art of the possible is with respect to bringing it into, let's say, closer into compliance.
Don't we want to ask him to do that?
I don't think, having worked with Stephen in the past, he's quite good, and I think we'll utilize him, but I think first we need, people get married to their designs. They get very close to their designs, and I think the first exercise should be determining what the right answer is, maybe, or looking at the different scenarios, and then if we were to go into a design and be able to save some of the design, then we would definitely approach Ehrlich to see what he might.
What is your timeline on this?
We hope to have something by the first quarter of next year. We've already got the other architect on board, and they're going to start right away. Go working with the campus. I'm sorry?
Who's the other architect?
Deloitte. And they're going to be working with the people at the college is aware of what we're doing, and the stakeholders are aware of what we're doing. So we're working with them in conjunction with them, and the president has been great. She realizes that she has a bit of a challenge on her hands, so she's been very responsive and is very excited about this too. And I believe that the folks on the campus are coming around as well, because they just want to see some movement, and they know they need a theater.
I think you're doing it the right way. I don't have an issue with it, but I think at the end of the day, he's going to want to maintain the design, and you can put it to him.
No, I'm certain that would be had somehow in a perfect world, if there were severable portions of the building and we could eliminate, 20 or 30,000 square feet, maybe this portion or this portion would be easily done. I don't really know that yet. And I'm hoping this other architect, we're not bringing them on to design the building, mind you. We're bringing them on to help us form solutions with respect to what we can do and what makes sense.
Well, the whole utilization thing scares me. Because I personally don't believe that you can make these into even an economic break even to the public kind of thing.
No.
There are too many of them in L.A. They're too competitive. I used to be involved in the past in the Playhouse and various other things. It's a tough world out there to even cover your operating costs. But if you can't justify it for the number of students using it, that's a problem.
This truly might end up being one of those gifts that keeps on taking.
And that's always the problem with trophy buildings like that. People have gotten talked into saying, you can rent this out for concerts and stuff, and you realize that that's just not a possibility.
Well, when we've looked into the other theaters, it's just not being utilized, even on the private side, or people aren't buying. But we're going to go through that exercise one more time. I think people got really excited when they knew they were getting a new theater, and they designed a really nice theater. Just have to make sure it makes sense for everybody. The next is one that you're familiar with, and this one we're going to keep on here until we get the solution. We're working to the solution. That's the Media and Performing Arts Building at Mission College. If you recall, this is one that was constructed or began construction. The contractor went out of business. The surety was brought on board. The surety brought on board Kemp Brothers, which is a capable contractor, to be the completion contractor. It was then that we started doing some investigations with respect to the quality of the construction and found a lot of defects, mainly in the connections and the steelwork. We halted construction until we could discover exactly what they were. We went back and did our forensic investigations to determine exactly what the extent of the failures or the lack of quality, let's say. We have gone back to DSA in several different packages, like a fixed package, and they've been working very closely with us. So we go back to DSA with we have our designers design something to fix the defects. We take it to DSA. It goes through the DSA cycle. They approve that package, that portion of the package, or that part of the floor. Then the constructor can continue to construct and to fix the defects. And we've been going through that process. I believe we have three packages approved so far, is that correct? And three floors, I believe, right? And so they're working away on the defects, and then ultimately they'll be able to, once they get the defects complete and fixed, DSA accepts those, what's put into place, and then we can begin or continue on with the construction in a quality fashion.
Was the stuff monocoated? Would you not be monocoated?
I don't even think it was monocoated yet. I don't think we got that far.
We did.
It was fireproof, wasn't it? Yeah, it was fireproof.
So that makes it harder to figure out.
Yeah, that's exactly what we had to do, because we had to go back and scrape it all off. Yeah.
What does that mean, monocoated?
It's a fireproofing. So it's this nasty spray on. If you pulled up one of these ceiling tiles, you'd see that the girts and the joists and everything up there is sprayed with like this nasty, crumbly.
It looks paper.
It's probably not hazardous anymore.
It's not
but
hazardous
I thought it was
anymore.
About 20 years ago.
Steel isn't fireproof. So in buildings that are taller than, I forget what, in California, two stories or something like that, you have to spray something on called monocoat. It's very sticky. And once it dries, it's very hard to get off because it's got to withstand massive amounts of heat. And it covers up all the weld problems because you can't see the weld.
That's right. And then the other side note, the other form commonly used in our industry to is intumescent paint to put onto the steel. But that's very expensive as opposed to the monocoat. It's usually only used in specialized applications in which the steel is going to be exposed or something along that lines. But we're actually making some progress, so I think that's the good news. Now, could it happen faster? Yeah, but we were actually kind of surprised at how quickly DSA has been turning around these jobs. So we're pretty happy right now. They've been helpful to us.
Rewelding or adding steel to the joints?
In some cases, it is rewelding because In some cases, the contractor put in bolted connections where they need welded connections, or welded connections where they need bolted connections, and in some cases where the
you were making it up.
In some cases where the bolt holes didn't line up, they used the old heat wrench to get in there and make the holes. And you know, I mean, it was your
wow.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly quality construction. And then this is a new one, and this started off kind of spooky. It was a central utility plant that Chevron installed in 2010 at East LA College, and they've suffered an inordinate amount of breaks in the piping, predominantly in the underground piping. And what we're finding, we went in and did some exploration, and there's still a question as to whether they used the right scheduled pipe. But what they didn't do was put thrust blocks in a lot of the 90s, so that's just a fancy term for a big chunk of concrete that controls lateral force in the pipes. And if you don't have a thrust block at the 90s, oftentimes the pipes will the connections will fail. And that's what they were having failures with connections. Now usually this would be once it's covered up and once you've accepted it and the warranty's over, you're pretty much done. But Chevron has actually come back and has been helping us out and working on some of the solutions and have been willing to get in there and look at the engineering and work with us on it.
It's actually, is this gas?
It's
what's it?
No, it's chilled water predominantly, yeah. I thought Jake was there because he was the fellow that was working with Chevron. So
water?
I'm sorry?
Just water?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's not damaged?
No. And then with that, I'll turn it over. We talked a little bit about the risk register before and some of the risk analysis that we were doing in our effort to put a sophisticated, or not sophisticated, but a good risk management plan into place. And Terry, you want to talk a little bit about the risk register?
Sure. So as part of our formal risk management program, every project has a register. We also have a register at the program level. So we put together a sample risk register here that shows you some of the risks that we would capture. And one of the things I'd like to highlight is this really starts at project inception. For projects that are currently in progress, we are also doing them, but it's critical that you start at the very beginning of a project so that you can start mitigating potential risks early. So if we take a look at the risk register, everybody has one of those. Obviously, each risk gets numbered. It's done by project. We include the contract number. And then we start to track the specifics of the risk itself. So when the risk was raised, who it was raised by. And then we start to go into the description of the risk. The first one is lag time for DSA approval, which will be a common risk on all projects, since that does take some time. The consequence of that is a project delay. And then we start to look at the likelihood of that risk, what the impact level of the risk is, and then it gets assigned in color. If you look at the second sheet behind that, it does give you a little guidance as far as, you know, very high, we'll get a brighter red risk. As you go down to medium, it's more of an orange color. Then as you go to low or very low, it starts to be green. Same kind of methodology for the impact. A very high risk will get red. So obviously when you start to look at the risk register, your eye is going to be drawn to those red risks to attack first. And that's how we prioritize them. Average number of risks that we see on a project is about 30. So it would be very difficult to attack all 30 at the same time. That's why we attack those red risks first and we start to put risk mitigation plans together. We track all the actions that are taken until the risk is resolved, or in some cases the risk is accepted. So maybe we know that there's a material that's been specified that during the design was at one price point. Now that we're in construction, it's at a much higher price point. That gets tracked as a risk. There isn't a lot to ability to mitigate that risk unless we want to change materials. So in that case, we might accept the risk and it becomes an issue. It gets taken off of the risk register and it goes more on an issue log, and at that point it's managed as an issue. We track, as I said, all the actions that are taken. Each risk, it gets assigned an owner without one belly button, one point of contact. It's very hard to manage these. So in some cases it might be the CPM, in some cases it might be the PMO, it may be the district.
You said one belly button?
One belly button. Sorry, one point of contact. Sorry.
I never heard that reference.
Okay. The other industry term is one throat to choke. So the belly button's a nice way to say it.
Official term now.
Got it.
And then we also give a due date for when the risk needs to be mitigated. Obviously, we track this, and some things will take longer, and we'll adjust the dates, but that's what the risk register does. Again, it starts at programming when you identify the project, and then it gets manipulated throughout until the project goes into closure. Trying to think of other highlights of the risk register. Does anybody have any questions on the register?
So, a couple questions.
Sure.
I mean, first of all, I think it's great, by the way.
Yeah.
These are the kind of tools that I love for any massive, complex projects. What I'm sure there's a materiality question you try to sort of use, like a risk is only worth tracking if it means we're going to spend so much more money, or we have this much risk, or this much time. What is that a judgment call? Like, this is
yes.
A big risk versus a baby risk?
Good question. So once we identify the risk and we validate the risk, we do a cost estimate. We put a price to each risk, and that helps us also prioritize it. Also, once we look at all the risks, validate, we put the cost in, we do have some modeling software that we apply to this that helps us also look at the risks and see which ones are the ones we need to pay attention to. So really the big driver here is going to be time and money, and we'll do an analysis to get
there. So you try to monetize a risk.
We do.
And the monetized element is what triggers a materiality.
Yes, sir.
Or prioritization.
Yes.
Okay, that's smart.
And then we set aside that amount or a portion of that amount depending upon what the... what we believe the risk will occur, and then that money set aside to account for it if it comes into play. And then we also, obviously, with monetary value assessed to it, we want to mitigate that risk so that it's never realized.
So let's say we have a project that had a budget of
has a budget of $30 million. And it looks like we're going to spend $30 million, and we have a risk that we assign that $1 million to. Does that project then become a $31 million project, or do we take from our contingency, our overall district-wide contingency? How do we...
It would be budgeted as part of the project. Any of the risks associated with that particular project is budgeted as part of the project. And ideally, in a perfect world, once again, you do this at the beginning of the program. First of all, you'd start with a program risk analysis, perform something very similar to this, except for even much larger. And then before any project was either realized or allowed to go forward, you would do a risk analysis such as this, so to make sure that budget accommodates the enough money for any of the risks associated with that particular project. And as
so
you know,
this is another way for us to avoid the problem of what happens when we've got 9 projects underway, we're at the end of that campus's allocation for them because we've got risk factors that put this into 110%.
And that's the ultimate failure, is to start something and not be able to finish it. And that's the biggest fear of any program manager. And this helps support that calamity.
So are we going to start to get this? Is that the way this works? Or?
We certainly can. Absolutely. When
I would think we'd want the very top band. I don't know how many will be on this. I don't want to see 500.
I think if I may make a suggestion, I'm certainly willing to have it modified to avoid massive sheets of things like this, because we already did that. If you could, like you're doing now, essentially what you're doing now is essentially this set, which is the riskiest thing. If you could talk to us about the riskiest ones that have really unsolvable problems, really impactful in terms of money, and what we're doing about it, mostly when something like has a DSA problem, not really interested.
Because,
DSA is always going to be a problem.
And some of the projects we have coming forward will have inherent risk built into them, whether they be this project we're talking about, you know, this digging into an old building. We have to dig into this old building that's been, you know, built 50 years ago, and we're going to do modernization of it. We talk about those risks at the front end. That's something that we can share with you as well, that when we realize a project and are going to go forward with it, point out the risks that we are tracking most closely.
This North Mall thing is still kicking around in my head. It seems to me like just an extremely risky project.
It was a lot more risky before. It's going to get a lot less risky very soon. But yeah, you're exactly right. It's exactly what you'd expect, digging into 50-year-old buildings and trying to modernize
them. I always get nervous when somebody, and I'm not faulting you, but somebody says, well, the reason we're going ahead is because we've already spent so much money.
No. Well, Dan, put it this way. When I went out there to take a look at it, the path forward, to me, after listening to everybody talk about that job, was a big D8. And just to bulldoze the entire thing. And that was what was in my mind until I actually got out there and walked every one of those 11 buildings and then looked at the site, because I was thinking exactly what you are. I'm like, these are 50-year-old buildings. I don't care how far along they are. We had a poor constructor before. We're going to run into more quality issues, blah, 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 blah. And that's what was going through my head. But at the point that they left construction, in many cases, you really couldn't screw a whole lot up. Because none of the finishes are done on any of these buildings, and my concern is with some of the equipment that's out there. We would have had to pay for that either way, if it's good or bad. But we're going to go in and actually take a look.
My only hope is, I'll leave it obviously to you guys, is that when we're done, the buildings are buildings that the campus really wants, and they really work and are really useful.
This is kind of the softer part of this job too, but I mean, we're even making them blend in with the rest of the campus with regards to, they needed new roofs, for instance, so we changing the color of the roof tiles to blend in with some of the new construction out there. And even, you know, they all have gables on them, so all the pitches are fitting with the rest of the buildings. And while they're not exciting buildings, and they're certainly not architecturally significant in my mind, they do fit in well with the rest of the campus, and it flows pretty nicely.
I mean, I do think that in the private sector, the principle of sunk cost is something you can swallow because it's your own. In the public sector, we've invested taxpayers' money partially through So the idea of sunk cost has to be tested at a much higher level.
I agree.
Probably what you intuitively sort of judged upon.
The waste considerations.
If they turn out to be good, usable buildings, then it's wonderful. If somebody at the end of all this, after we're all gone, comes back and says, you know, I never wanted those buildings, I never liked those buildings, I'm not going to use those buildings,
I think the time to say that would have been about 7 years ago. And the good news is the one of the procurement methods that we're using on this one should get a good quality contractor on it. It will be a qualifications based selection with prices component, but the main focus will be on your ability, your approach, your phasing, and the quality of your company that we're looking for. So, because it's got to be really collaborative, because you know it's every building's a different. Different design complete, it's a real mess. I wanted to draw your attention to a document that looks like this, and it's called the Settled Claims Report. And this reflects some of the settled claims deals that we've done over the last 6 weeks. I think the good news here, and it's not reflected on here anyways, and I don't have any metrics to attach to, is that we are seeing a bit of a decrease in a lot of the push for claims from many of the contractors. We're really getting in front of the issues out on the job right now and trying to solve them, make business decisions to move forward before we ever try to get into a nasty claims deal with any of the GCs. My experience, it's always much, much cheaper to try to make business decisions and solve them at the project level than to go to these forms. But many of these are years and years old, and they're old cases and moldy oldies that we are now settling and getting out of the way. Case seven.
There's a story there.
Oh, there certainly is. And this is that... that parking structure city. This one has been going on for 13 years.
Which one is this?
Where is it?
Number seven.
Okay, so 10
Number
years.
Seven.
And we're actually recouping money from a design.
From
his E&O carrier, right?
Now,
this does not reflect, I must warn you, we can't get too excited about the $2.7 million because that's, I'm sure there was plenty of legal fees expended to get that $2.7 million.
And our claim was for $7.6 million.
The claim amount that was an affirmative claim. That was the claim the contractor got us, right?
We had a mix of things going on in that building because we had a significant part of this started because we had a significant delay claim.
We only received $2 million.
The significant delay claim was from general contractor Bomell. And the delay was caused by an extensive dispute with ESA over the design of the shoring system. We actually had to pay Bomell $5 million because, frankly, we just had the exposure on the claim.
And that was because of the ESA?
No. To be fair, some of it was that. Some of it was the district's doing, and some of it was arguably the CPM is no longer there, and so... There were more than one contributor to that thing. So I think what Jim was just trying to say is the $2.7 million doesn't make us truly whole, but it is significantly improved over what it was.
It's better than a stick in the eye.
But we're getting rid of, do we have other 10-year-old cases that are still bad? I assume that's a stupid question.
There's some other moldy oldies on here. I think that Masters out of Mission, how many years has that been going on?
That's a couple.
It's been 3 years, right?
Three or four years. I was going to say, the case goes back to around 2005, but the building project probably goes back to 10 years. But yeah.
I mean, that's pretty old to me.
So we're waiting for these faster than they're coming in the door. We're getting them out the door.
Yes, that's the message here. So these are getting cleaned up, and then we're trying to stay out of this business going forward, meaning we're just doing a lot of work to get in front of these issues and not letting them. What happens is when they fester, they usually get more complex. So the quicker you can solve them, stop the bleeding, make a decision on what you're going to do, whichever way you're going to go on it, and then act. So that we don't end up with things that are 10 years old. And we're not dealing with these in 2020. But I think 13 of these gone away in 6 weeks is pretty decent progress.
That's good. Remember the list of all
No, I mean, so other people work on that now.
And I think with that, Dan.
One question. I will ask this question at every meeting. How are the campuses doing on master planning? Are they getting close to having master plans that they're comfortable with? There's an issue I know between how much money they believe they have and how much money the district believes they have.
Yep.
How is that process all coming together?
The process came together very well.
I guess they won't ask it every meeting.
Well, we have one outlier campus that can't quite that's got a little bit more work to do, but I believe that we've all made a decision on how we're going to move forward with respect to the projects, and we also have the I call the nuclear option on some of these campuses where okay, let's say everything went to hell, what would you cut out still that's left? What we have is a chess piece. We're not totally vested in that. If we have to hold back, we have to cancel something. We have contingency plans for each of the campus. We still have one that's going to be a bit of a struggle getting there. We've got about a $40 million deficit that we're trying to work through.
On the ones that we have reached nirvana with, were there a lot of canceled projects?
Not so much canceled projects. A lot of it was planning, and in some. We had to cancel a few, or we deferred them, meaning we need that contingency built into the current projects, because in some cases people weren't carrying enough contingency. There wasn't a standardized contingency of what they were required to carry. So some people thought they could get away with carrying a few points of contingency. When you look at our change order rates, you know that's not reality, and the projects are going to. So we've asked them to carry a recommended contingency for each of the projects. Build it into the budgets, in which case meant that they didn't have enough money at the end of the job to finish all the projects. So they would then defer that last, let's say this last project they prioritize, put that last project and say, okay, well, hopefully if everything's, unicorns and baby kittens, then we're going to be able to build this and it'll be
good. So there's some projects that may not even start in the design phase for 3 years.
Now, there's going to be a couple outliers. But in most cases, I would like to have the vast majority of what we have for this program completed in 36 months. And if I can make it go faster, after we set the goal of getting these priorities done and everything wrapped up, so everybody knows what success looks like, if you will, by the end of this year. So starting January 1, my focus then turns to how do we compress that schedule? Because the 36 months is very, very aggressive. But that's okay, I want to push on the people. I want it to be aggressive because the soft cost in this program is very expensive for us. But the next thing is going to be to compress those schedules. Now, I say the soft cost is expensive. There's also been a huge effort underway to right-size many of the staffs that we have currently on the college campuses. We've been a little heavy in some spaces, meaning I don't know that we've been scaling them appropriately to the amount of work that's been going on. So we've now done that and scaled them down, which should equate to several million dollars over the remainder of the program. We're looking for somewhere between $30 and $60 million of savings, just the soft costs. And that's still nobody's happy about it. I met with all the principals of the firms that we currently have working. Everybody's singing the blues, but when I explained to them that there's not that much money left, guys, this is the evolution of a project.
Well, we're adequately staffed. Even with this aggressive, let's get finished, have a lot of projects going on.
Yeah, we have to take that into account because you can't step over a dollar to pick a dime. One mistake can pay for a whole staff. Meaning, one person because if they're overworked, you don't have enough people, makes a $1 million error. That pays for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So we take that in mind anytime that we're staffing these things. A lot of the efficiencies that we're talking about, the savings, are going to be coming from, if you will, regionalizing some of the central services that you might have at these individual campuses. So everybody on the program, we probably have 15 schedulers out there, let's say, on our program. We don't need that many schedulers for the amount of work we have left, but every campus has one, you know, every college has one. So what we'll then do is probably go down to 3. So you'll have a regional scheduler that'll handle 3 campuses, and that's, with the amount of work left, that's not too much work. Also, we'll be looking at the cost accounting folks that do a lot of cost controls and project controls, as well as centralizing some of the estimating functions, because right now, I think every college has estimators, but we don't need that many estimators. So we're looking, once again, for economies of scale here and trying to look at this as an enterprise approach as opposed to an individual college approach. And that's where we think we nearly cut the staff we have in half. Yeah, so that's an effort that's undergoing right now.
Anybody have any questions, concerns for our construction group? Do we have time constraints? Do you want to go next? Okay.
Good report.
Okay.
Thank you. So, appreciate that. Thank you.
From the interesting to the procedural stuff, only lawyers love, but you know, somebody's got to love it. Attachment C of your original package was a proposed revision to the bylaws. And my first draft of this in the previous iteration was to update these bylaws consistent with the board rule change about the configuration of the committee. In response to the interests articulated in the last meeting, I think, or the meeting at each, I added on page 3 of those draft bylaws some language as a starting point to deal with the possible addition of a third term for members. And we had talked about how a third term ought to be based on something, and so this is what I came up with. And so that you'll see it's an addition being underlined to show it's an addition. It's also highlighted. And so that was designed to address what you asked about, you know, which was this idea of adding third term. Okay. So these bylaws are actually passed in the framework of an administrative regulation of the district, which means that they're subject to the approval of the chancellor, but they don't have to go to the board of trustees because they're an administrative regulation. So. Of course, ultimately, the appointment for us to be made by the Board of Trustees is such a thing to occur. And so, essentially, what you have is what I would call cleanup stuff that's designed to reconcile the board rule and then the addition that you asked for.
Does anyone have any comments?
Yeah, why are we getting rid of the one representative from each college?
Well, I think that it would be safe to say that one of the struggles that this committee, as have all the committees, have is the ability to make quorum. And we've been criticized quite severely by the State Controller's Office about the regularity of the Oversight Committee meetings. And one of the reasons that we can't show that they can meet is because of the number of times we've had trouble making quorum. So the board made a policy decision to go to a smaller size committee. So now, instead of a quorum that required, nine or ten or eleven, something like that. We're now at a quorum of 6,
yeah,
which is much more viable in terms of the committee convening and doing the legal work that it's required to do. So that's why.
I also think it got to be that people felt that they didn't show up was okay. There was somebody else there. And we had a lot of dedicated people who would show up at every meeting, and about every other meeting, we wouldn't have a quorum, so we really couldn't do anything, so it wasn't fair.
Well, I'm just concerned because I think this runs in the opposite direction of what the whole Oversight Committee concept was, and that was to really reflect from the ground up. And now by cutting the colleges out, I mean, I'm not sure you have to have one from every college, but I think the way this works is you're really putting this into the hands of an entirely different group, as I see it, that's really going to be controlled by the chancellor rather than coming from the ground up.
You know, the assumption about control by the chancellor, I don't really see that, but the board's already made this policy decision.
And to address that particular aspect, I have spoken with the college presidents because I believe it's Cityside where we actually have a vacancy. Is that correct, Tom?
Yeah.
I think it's a Cityside. So talking with three college presidents, they'll, you know, talk with their citizens oversight committees and jointly make a recommendation to me. So it's not like I'm going to go in or that a future chancellor will go in and make a selection. But it's consultation among the three regions. So we've looked at it and on a regional basis, asking the college presidents to make a recommendation based on discussions with their college citizens oversight committee and, you know, reaching agreement as to a regional representative. So that's how we're looking at it. I know that it's not spelled out quite like that, you know, under item one, but that was the procedure that we agreed to.
And then I should note that the numbers are a little wrong. The lawyer, I knew the words, not the math, right? So the A2 and G, at the beginning, and at G should be 7 additional members appointed by the board, and then down at the bottom of G should be 1 at large number. That's what we correctly stated. So that the 10 are, there's a statutory list of requirements, certain kinds of representatives that have to be placed on the committee. And then the rest are sort of up to date, that's why. And then, so the at-large membership and the regional membership are the kind of district policy ones that have been added.
Doesn't each campus have a district an oversight committee?
They do.
And don't they report to this committee?
They were advisory to this committee, but the board rule change also allowed for what is now included in the proposed bylaw change on page 2. And on page 2 of the...
it says each college...
The reason it says that language is because when the board put forward Proposition A, it provided for a college-level committee, a committee at each college. But Proposition AA and Major J did not include that language. So in theory, our legal mandate to have a committee at each college is exhausted once the last dollar of Proposition A is exhausted. However, we've always treated all three propositions, we've always treated them the same. And so what the board had put in its policy is the same language that you see here in B4, which allows that when a college is sort of at the tail end of its process, that the committee doesn't go away as much as it kind of joins this one and becomes merged into this one. So that we're meeting our legal requirements to continue down to the last dollar, but we're not asking a group of volunteers to meet when there's very little to meet to review.
Do the minutes of this committee get sent to each of the campus oversight committees?
I don't know.
Well, you know, if you're trying to be reasonable in terms of quorums, which I happen to agree with because this is a problem for most organizations, I think if the communication level was raised so that the campuses and this committee communicated with each other, it would resolve some of that issue.
One of the problems we had in the past is that the offending members intended to be the campus representatives. They were the ones who wouldn't show up, and I'm sure they have.
They would or would not.
Would not show up.
Yeah.
So
right.
That was the problem.
That was the problem.
So, and we had originally structured this idea where we were going to have each campus representative make a presentation on a rolling basis through board meetings of what was going on at their campus, and that never went anywhere. Because we couldn't get people to come and we couldn't get them to make presentations. So we relied on Jim to tell us what's going on at the campuses. If we want to, and maybe a solution to this is to send out the notice of the meetings, meeting materials to those campus committees and invite any member of that campus committee to come to these meetings and talk to us about issues. We don't run a very Robert's Rules of Order, or at least I don't, meeting here.
Sure.
People who want to talk can talk and discuss and have issues raised. And I've now been involved in this for 6 years through two chancellors. I have never felt put upon by a chancellor of what we're supposed to do and not supposed to do. So if that's just a matter of communication, I'd say we ought to get them involved pre-meeting and then send the meeting minutes to them afterwards. And if they want to come and talk.
Well, I'm sorry, I have to meet some doctor's appointment. That's my suggestion.
I agree with that.
So
that doesn't have to be reflected in a bylaw, but it could be good practice.
Just our procedure. If we can do that, that would be great.
And you could, if you thought it was wiser, you could have a standing item, you know, that invited. I don't know that it's necessary, but I'm just pointing out that we'll forget today's conversation. And if you don't kind of do something that's process continuous, then you'll
lose
it.
Well, we can put that on the agenda or the email that goes with the agenda to say that for all those members of the various campus planning committees or building committees or whatever we call them, that they're cordially invited to attend our meetings and participate. And we're sending them the materials in advance so they can participate on an educated basis.
I have a question on that. You said building planning committees. You're talking about the system oversight committee?
Yes.
Okay. And should that be officially recommended by the citizen oversight as opposed to one member of the citizen oversight deciding to come talk about whatever issue on their mind? I mean, it's up to you. I'm just
asking. They're legally entitled. They're legally entitled. Anybody's legally entitled to address this body. And some of you have been here for some of those more robust
questions. And after we lost Vandy Camp, we lost our public attention. It's never been.
So you don't have public comment anymore.
No.
Well, obviously public comment will always be here. I'm just trying to figure out your invitation, how I should word it on my denied admission, because I'm going to be meeting with my citizen on site. So what should I say?
I think that you can say that it's, unless I'm speaking out of turn here, that it's the feeling of the committee that we would welcome participation by the campus level oversight committees, and they are more than welcome. We are going to start including them on our distributions.
Well, let me amend that to say that we will send it to the college presidents, because my permanent office is going to be burdened with that, sending out those notifications.
Okay, let's send it to the college. And if you have members, who change, go on and off, you know about it, and it makes it easier. But the college presidents then will be responsible for informing their oversight committee people, and they are cordially invited to come and listen and talk and participate.
Yep. Very good.
We can do that.
Anybody object to that as a feeling, a sense of the committee? So do you want an action on this?
Yes, please.
Okay. I had a chance to read this. I don't know if everybody else has. I would entertain a motion to approve these changes to bylaws. Second. Are there any discussion, any dissents?
I'm an abstention here.
Okay. We have one abstention.
I think you actually need.
Need a positive vote?
Okay. Well, if I can get this correct, the only thing we're really voting on is changing these bylaws
We don't have a quorum.
If he abstains, then we'll be here.
Well, and no, your bylaws are also being changed to reconcile them with the new board rules as well.
But the other items, we don't have any say.
The board has adopted that policy. You could go tell the board if you didn't agree, but correct.
If we don't make these changes, our bylaws would be in contradiction to the rules of the trustees, which I don't think we can do.
Which will trump them. And when I ask the chancellor to sign off on them, I'll say you shouldn't sign off on bylaws that are inconsistent with the trustees' board rule.
So,
well, close something here. I see now. I see what the chancellor said. The three regional members will come from the college oversight meeting.
Yes.
And then there's going to be one at-large member.
Yes.
Why not eliminate the one at-large member and have four regional members?
That's a statutory.
Yeah, statutory says it defines the.
No,
there's
not
the
at-large.
Yeah,
at-large
yeah,
large.
Yeah, it is in the.
No, it's not.
Okay.
No, that large position isn't a statutory position. But maybe it will help you that within the district culture, there are city side colleges, valley side colleges, and seaside colleges. And they are grouped together regionally that way for many different purposes. So grouping them together for this purpose would be consistent with the other things the district does.
But I understand what you're saying, Mr. Anderson, which is. That fourth member somehow be from one of the colleges or from an oversight committee. Is that?
Yes.
That's actually one of the things we talked about, not formally in that regard, but.
It may be the most willing.
Yeah.
We obviously want someone to come.
You know my recommendation to you? That would be a consideration in recommended to be appointed at large.
So it could be the first consideration really would be to seek
someone
a recommendation of one of the
that serves on an at-large basis.
The only thing I would say when you keep in mind is that we were criticized in the past for not having more technical knowledge on the being so college heavy and not having enough technical industry people
right.
on the committee, so just.
Well, and we're trying to in the discussion with the college presidents, we're also asking that of their for their consideration as well when we get together and have that discussion.
Well, let me ask, since I made a motion. Would it satisfy this request to amend my motion? And that my motion would say we would adopt these as proposed, but we would further request that in the implementation of these, that the chancellor first look to possible volunteers from existing campus oversight.
For the at-large position?
For the at-large.
That sounds good.
Would that help, do you think?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I made the motion. Is there, who was my second?
Did
you concur that?
Okay. I think because we're barely at the necessary votes, I will ask all those people who are in favor of that motion as amended to say aye.
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 I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, we got four.
Nay.
I'll go nay.
Okay. 4-2.
4-2?
So it fails.
No.
Can I add a motion in the discussion? Or?
We can discuss it some more.
Okay. On that large, I think it should be open to everybody. I know that's my concern. I mean, it's appointment by the trustees.
Right.
I think I would let the trustees make that decision on.
It's the trustees make the vote, but it is a recommendation of the chancellor.
But we need six votes.
So you need unanimous vote because there are six people here.
Right.
Yeah. So the majority of the committee to adopt the change.
Okay.
So
so, and you only have a majority of the board.
My objection is, we've got this in-law imbalance. We've got one representative from three colleges, just like everybody else does. And I'm fine with that. And I am fine with an at-large, but I don't know that we ought to give somebody on the college the benefit when they may not be the right person, and the college may not have the right person.
But if I can respond, I think that motion allows for the chancellor to take that into consideration. No. Does it require that the at-large person be a member of the college the various college oversight committees? It says that, I forget how the language was, but it says that that will be
a consideration.
But it,
so I don't believe at the end of the day that that's how it's going to work practically.
Basically, the way it's written at the large, I mean, you're still doing the discussion. I just don't think of the recommendation of where it should go. I mean, that's up to you.
If that's what you want to do as the chancellor, that's okay.
Yeah.
But I don't want it written in.
Can I encourage one of my no votes to make a motion and see if we can win six votes? As long as I want to be willing to make a motion.
I'll make a motion as written.
Here's what I would like to see.
Okay.
And I have no idea how to codify this, that when the chancellor is looking at potential people to fill this position, that they look at two things. One, if they are currently involved in a college at, and I don't care what level that is, but that they also have some kind of construction industry kind of background, because we're always light on that in the committee. But that's really only a recommendation. It may change over the years as to what we're looking for from a board member, and one of the nice things about at large is it can be anybody. And the problem with some of our other designations is it's very limited and very targeted, and it's difficult sometimes to find a person who's willing to serve but also happens to wear a certain senior citizen hat or some other kind of hat. And I just don't really think it's wise to tie the chancellor's hand. I don't think it's that easy to find people who want to serve. Yeah, and it's not like, you know, it's not like running for president with like 87 people who want to do it. It takes some real work to get somebody who's willing to serve and show up. So I think tying people's hands makes it that much more difficult.
I just have full confidence that the chancellor is going to know how to pick this at-large person. And I don't understand why it has to be written into anything. They're just going to do it. That's my problem with it.
Well, I don't agree.
Okay.
You know? Well, say, I think your motion, Kim's motion over here, was a very workable resolution of this. It would allow the chancellor to take that into consideration, but not require a tie of her hands on that item. And I think to disagree with that just baffles me, but that's my view.
Oh, that's okay.
Well, what's the sense of this committee? There's no point in discussing any longer. Is there any solution that gets us to six votes, or do we just...
How many are we at now?
Four to two. If we direct the chancellor to consider people from the campuses, I guess we're at 5-1 if we leave it as written.
If we leave it as written, who's the... Oh, he is against.
Right.
Gotcha.
Do I hear a solution to this problem? I guess we're not going to pass it.
Well, David, David started making a motion.
Right.
Do you want to take another vote on David's motion? He's made a motion.
I thought he said
that was
written.
Can I?
Words in your mouth? I'm sorry.
No. Well, go ahead. You will.
I was just going to offer the thought that we have to follow the board rule. The board rule will trump the administrative regulations anyway. So if you don't pass it,
It's passed.
It has the effect of being passed anyway. You know what I'm saying? So the only thing that failing to pass it will do is that it will not get you to the third term that you wanted to authorize.
Yep.
Because the other stuff has already been imposed upon you without the qualifiers. Maybe something that's close to the language that you suggested, which is a motion that the committee recommends the chancellor consider current involvement in colleges and construction background in making a recommendation for the at-large member, but that it's not necessarily included in the bylaws, but it becomes part of the minutes and the permanent record of this committee.
How do people feel about that?
And that pretty much covers everything.
We're not going to do it as long as you're uncomfortable about the colleges getting cut down. So let's.
When's our next meeting?
Not until February.
How significant is it to pull this over to February?
We're not having a meeting in December.
No. December 13th.
Does the term question come up right now?
Bottom line is what Camille just said.
Well, good.
These are passed. They're done.
No, I understand.
Okay. So the only issue is this third term thing, which we certainly can put off until...
Does it affect us? Is anybody affected by the amendment of the third term question between now and February?
There would be some people who might be eligible for reappointment who wouldn't be reappointed. However, I will tell you this. In the absence of... Once again, the board's authority outweighs the committee's authority. So if the board determined to make an appointment for a third term following the education code, that would simply prompt another revision to the bylaws. So, you know what I'm saying? If the board wanted to make an appointment for a third term because the education code allowed it, the board could do that.
So we could take an item to the board in December, in essence.
Doing that, and all of this totally moved.
Yeah, we're trying to be respectful of the committee's role. And it's
totally understand, but if we can't, as a committee, agree to something that is essentially a fait accompli, then we are where we are.
Okay.
As I understand it, everybody who cycles off at the same time.
We have different terms.
Their cycling depends on when they were appointed,
uh-huh.
And people do get appointed at different times.
Because I think I'm cycling on before the end of my term as chairman.
I think it's September next year.
Okay.
One thing in my thoughts how we get there. Basically, I do want to see the third term. The question here is at that large, it's basically a recommendation from the chancellor to the board of trustees, right?
That's
I understand.
Right. The third term this term limit was specified based on the statute in the bylaws. That's the kind of thing in place you put it, not so much in the board rules, but the board has the authority and jurisdiction to determine to allow for that third term on its own.
Without a recommendation.
Yeah. Although you could vote to recommend to the board that a third term be allowed.
Why are we thinking third terms? If you look at the whole concept of district oversight committees, we're supposed to be rotating this around. We're not supposed to be keeping the same group of people here all the time.
Well,
finish?
Okay.
And that was the whole concept behind this. And it seems to me, I'm involved with my neighborhood council, and some of these neighborhood councils, just the same people are there that were there 10 years ago. And I think we need to refresh the blood on this advisory committee.
That has not been our problem. Our problem has been getting people to show up. And
The biggest problem has been getting people from the colleges to show up and participate and be involved and be informed. And our second biggest problem has been getting people who have some sort of construction background to be involved. And we have had a number of people who have done, I think, a superlative job of learning the industry over their term or two terms. And then just about the time they're very good at being involved and committed, they're turned out. That's why, and again, we have not had this press of people desperate to get on this committee and be involved. That's what we're doing. So it is all well and good to talk about getting new blood in here. We've not been able to get new blood in here.
We've not been able to get blood in here.
Yeah.
can I just add, though, I mean, I understand the point you're making, Terry. I don't think we're proposing go to unlimited terms. We're proposing adding one extra two-year term. That's a very measured sweet spot, I think, between rotation and competency and knowledge.
I'm going to raise that issue, though. Yeah. We need to be careful because we'll be here 2 years from now and say, well, we need a fourth term.
Yeah.
Actually, we couldn't do that.
You couldn't do it. The law actually says.
Yeah. What I want to tell you is the reason it was originally set at 2 years was because the education code said that it was 2 years, and then the education code was amended to allow for the third term. And then the language that I provided actually doesn't just sort of allow for an automatic rollover, but sets a standard for a third rollover, which was the debate.
The 90% rule, by the way, means that this would be almost like an honorary degree kind of thing, because we have very few people who make that 90% attendance.
So I don't know if you're so inclined to vote yes on this, but I would certainly be willing to make a motion to amend that portion of our bylaws today to separate that issue out if we had six votes. So at least I kind of hate to see you. I think we disempower ourselves when we can't come to any kind of agreement because we basically say we can't come to agreement, so therefore, trustees, you have to make decisions. And I hate to see us do it. And I think it weakens our credibility and legitimacy for the broader thing. It's not the end of the day, by the end of the world. But so if there were and you tell me that that's possible.
Yeah, it is. And let me just say, I think 90% out, you know, like this. Okay, I just wanted to put down something that was a high standard.
Go ahead, four
meetings. And I figured that was up to you guys.
How many meetings have
you
had?
Six. In theory. But you don't really end up having six a year. But I put 90% because I was just trying to establish a high standard as a talking point. There's nothing magic about that.
I would suggest that if our target is six, if somebody shows up for four.
Which is what?
That's
2/3.
That's 66% or 67%.
That's pretty good.
90% would essentially mean you had to come to all of them.
Right.
And I just...
Yeah, that's too high.
Kind of impossible for me.
That's too high.
I was deliberately trying to...
Understand. Could we have a motion that suggested your language except at the two-thirds level? Is that okay with you?
Yeah, I would make that motion.
Okay.
Well, why not? Yeah, on this, I would say, why not eliminate that requirement here?
I think that's an important requirement considering attendance has been one of our biggest problems.
Well, but I don't think you'd get appointed, not you, according to a particular board member, you'd get appointed to a third term if they weren't showing up to participate.
Well, I'm sort of concerned about what you're concerned about, which is some people just stay long after their effectiveness is gone. Anyway, that's the motion. Anyway, second that motion? Okay.
So that's the third term with 2/3 attendance?
Yes. With 2/3 attendance. All those in favor of that? Aye. Okay. That passes. We
will
stand silent on the other issue, but it is in effect in any case.
So let's bring it forward. I mean, I still think it's better that we make an affirmative decision, whatever it is. So hopefully we can reach an agreement on how to handle this very important question.
Yes. And I agree with your point, David.
we have a strange relationship with the trustees. They have the power to do absolutely everything. We only have the power to sort of sit and complain. And the trustees, in my experience, having been here, have been very good about being open with us, telling us the things they're doing. We have worked hard to maintain and improve our communication with the trustees. We have some trustees who show up at every meeting. We have the chancellor now coming to every meeting. So the communication is really good. I don't want to make it look like we can't play in that field by not being able to come to conclusions.
Part two, it's the handbook, which probably is a much easier conversation. The handbook is updated also for reconciling the renewal configuration as specified by the Board of Trustees.
Is that done at the beginning?
Should be done at the time. It probably should be done once a year. The conflict is appendix one.
Why don't you decide when we should give that out to everybody and have everybody fill it out?
Okay.
I don't want to lose that. Is there anything more?
I would just invite the committee to adopt the handbook.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay.
See you seconded.
You're on.
See you.
Well, actually, I was going to mention that by your question with regards to master planning and reconciliation, you took two of the items off. So that's fine. That has been covered. And truly, I think that Jim had covered in his construction update the projects that we're all working forward. I think probably just to keep this really short, one item of interest to all of you is that the board will very likely be interviewing candidates, applicants for the chancellor's position in December, and so that process is moving forward, and hopefully we'll know before too long what's what. And so that concludes my report.
Any new business? Any old business? Yes.
Just in page 8 of the annual report, happy to say it may have not been put in time, but Design Build Institute America gave your one new patent building in Center for Math and Science a national award for best education facility for the United States.
Wow.
Two. You're familiar with Design Build Institute America.
Right. We need to have this. Can we get this changed in the
The report actually reflects last year.
KJ has the photograph.
That's always an issue. We have this incredible lag between the time we have the year end.
Right.
Is there any reason why you can't say subsequently the building has to acknowledge it doesn't really?
You probably can. A problem has been that we've had this cutoff date, and it's very difficult to maintain a mental thing about what period we're talking about.
But no, let's give you the good news.
Let's get into the meeting so that when I have to start writing this next year, we can make sure that we're in. So if we have that building, and what was your second point?
That was it.
Oh, okay. Anything else?
Thank you for your participation. That was a really good discussion.